This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking. My name is Stephanie Wilder Taylor.
And I'm Dr. Tanmay Sharma.
And this evening, we're talking about harm reduction, how it's being used in the realm of addiction treatment, recovery, and rehabilitation. Oftentimes, people assume that addiction treatment and rehabilitation can only be an all-or-nothing process.
Well, traditional approaches view abstinence as the only way to recover from an addiction. But addiction is a chronic relapsing and remitting illness. Should we be taking an approach that might not always be in the patient's best interest? An approach known as harm reduction thus aims to minimize the negative consequences of drug abuse or drug use or substance use and minimize the harm to patients who suffer from addiction so that we can reduce morbidity and mortality. But this is an emotive topic. Some people swear by abstinence. Others think that they cannot actually participate in treatment because it is an all-or-none phenomena. We did a show almost 18 months ago now, I think, on harm reduction, and it was fairly emotive. We had two different camps, but I think today we are talking more about how can we reconcile harm reduction with our current views of treatment.
And to help us discuss this and figure out both sides, we're joined by Dr. Katie Wickwitz, who's a professor of psychology and scientist at the Center on Alcoholism, Substance Abuse, and Addictions at the University of New Mexico. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and has devoted the last 16 years of her career to developing and evaluating harm reduction treatments for alcohol and drug use disorders.
Well, Dr. Wickwitz, welcome to our show this evening.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, let me start off by asking all of us, if you like, to define harm reduction for the purpose of this show. In your view,
sure.
What is harm reduction?
Sure, great, thank you. And you did a great job of introducing it. I'm not sure what I can add to that definition, but the basic idea with harm reduction is that substance use, alcohol and drug use, causes a great deal of harm to the individual and society. And the notion that everyone is going to just stop using drugs or alcohol, we've learned, is not an ideal notion. It's not the case that people can just stop using when they want to. And so the idea with harm reduction is to take an approach that reduces the harm associated with alcohol or drug use. So that might mean stopping using altogether, and that would be kind of the end, ultimate harm reduction would be for people to abstain from substances. However, it also takes a very pragmatic stance that's probably not likely for a lot of individuals because addiction is a chronic relapsing condition, like you said. And so can we reduce the harm that alcohol or drugs cause? And there's a number of ways to do that via different target behaviors. So reducing sharing needles, for example, is one commonly used example of harm reduction. And that prevents HIV spread, and that prevents other disease spread, like hepatitis spread. So how can we reduce harm that individuals might cause themselves?
This is fine in terms of needle exchange, but people who drink, for example, let's take somebody who's been a social drinker, then this became a problem for them. How does harm reduction apply to people like that? Because the needle exchange, one can understand, okay, if you have clean needles, there's less chance of getting any of the infections, including HIV or hepatitis, whatever else that there is. So I think where the problem comes in is for people, especially who are drinking rather than taking drugs. And can you drink in moderation? And one would say that they've already crossed the Rubicon.
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question, and that's where I was going to go next, actually, because that's my primary line of work, is harm reduction with alcohol users. You know, the reality is that any reduction in alcohol drinking is associated with reduction in morbidity and mortality, and that's through a number of different ways. I mean, one, through physical health, but also through accidental injury and accidents. And so we work a lot with a term called protective behavioral strategies. So thinking about drinking reductions that either reducing the amount that you're drinking, which is going to reduce the harm, physical health harm, and also accidental injury and death harm, but also thinking about ways of maybe even drinking the same, but using strategies to protect your health and the society's health in other ways. So that would include using a driver instead of driving drunk. That would include making sure that children or people who you're caring for are taken care of by someone who's sober. There's other ways of reducing harm from alcohol that include behavioral strategies for reducing the harm that alcohol can cause, and also drinking reductions. And what we know from the biomedical data is that increasing drinking is associated with increasing harm. Therefore, decreasing drinking is associated with decreasing harm.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about harm reduction versus abstinence in treatment and recovery from addiction. And right now we're talking about alcohol. I know Dr. Sharma is pushing this over to me because I'm so curious. I've been sober, actually abstinent from alcohol for over 9 years. And I find the notion so interesting because, you know, having obviously through recovery been around tons of people, trying to quit drinking and in recovery. Do you find that when, I don't want to say when it's pushed, but when you give people the idea that, you know, they can just cut down or moderate, that it almost gives them like an out, like a shortcut when, I mean, I just noticed that like, I had to quit drinking entirely because the whole idea of, well, I'm gonna just drink the same amount, but I'm not gonna drive. Or, you know, I'm gonna drink the same amount, but, I'm gonna go to bed earlier so that I stop early. I mean, all of those things seem to me to be things that people who actually have alcoholism or an alcohol use disorder do before they get to the point that they go, I'm an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. And certainly what I have found in working with patients who come, I often work with patients who come to me and say, I want to be a moderate drinker. I want to reduce my drinking. And so we'll start with that goal if that's what they want. And then I've had several patients then say after kind of weeks of trying to moderate their drinking, you know, this is getting to be too hard. I'm just going to try abstinence. And that works better for them. And I'll also say that, you know, the most severe individuals with alcohol use disorder often find that moderate drinking doesn't work for them. That, like you said, that they can't just say, I'm going to just go to bed earlier. And that what those people ultimately find is that abstinence is a safer route for them, and that's the best harm reduction for them is to be abstinent.
But from my experience, I would say that that's actually just as true for people who aren't the worst alcoholics, that, you know, the fact that you're a person who drinks too much or is dependent on alcohol and finds that you can't stop drinking means that you're the type of person who, I mean, I know for myself, I didn't drink in huge quantities, but when I drank, I was very unpredictable, right? So
yeah.
I'm not somebody who could, I guess I'm saying that I find that a lot of people who drank like I did, which wasn't in huge quantities, but it was the type of drinking and, you know, have tried moderating, right? And then you find that each time that you subsequently have an episode where you relapse or, you know, or don't drink in moderation, something bad happens to make you go, I'm never going to drink again. Do you know what I'm saying? So I just wonder if, like, I don't know, I've just talked to so many people that, like, I'm just going to moderate. Well, no, you're probably not going to moderate if you have a drinking problem.
Well,
I'm getting heated up about this. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I just think it's important to recognize that alcohol use disorder does exist on a continuum.
Right.
And all the data supports that in fact, most people with an alcohol use disorder reduce their drinking on their own in the absence of treatment and never have to declare themselves an alcoholic and never actually get to the stage where they probably can't moderate their drinking. And that's the majority of people with an alcohol use disorder. Certainly the upper 10% is kind of the group of folks who struggle with a moderate drinking approach. But we have to consider that the other 90% maybe could benefit and would be more likely to come into treatment if they learn that they could moderate their drinking. And a good deal of those folks actually never come to treatment and they reduce their drinking on their own. One of my kind of really exciting areas of research right now is trying to understand those folks is how do these individuals reduce on their own and really trying to understand if we can then bring that into the treatment realm to help people. But I recognize what the passion, you know, and my experience in this field is that anyone I've talked to who's been really successful in sobriety and obtaining recovery via abstinence, they feel like that's the only way. And when I've talked to people who've been successful with reduced drinking, there's a little bit more, it just opens your eyes that there is more of a continuum of drinkers out there, that some people actually can moderate their drinking, whereas others actually, like you said, really struggle.
What in that case, what are the characteristics, if you like, of people that might be successful, moderators is not the right word, but who can drink in moderation, if you like?
You know, that's such a good question, but here's what I want to do. I'm so sorry to interrupt. Let's go to a break and then let's come back and answer that question. And then we're going to bring in another guest, Stephanie Campos from Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles, to join in our discussion. You're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health. We'll be right back.
It had taken over my life. It needed to be stopped.
Addiction doesn't discriminate. At Sovereign Health, we target underlying conditions that occur along with addiction. Our clinical experts provide both individual and group therapy and retrain the addicted brain through cognitive enhancement.
Getting treatment at Sovereign, it's what gave me my life back.
Call 866-201-8710. That's 866-201-8710. Or visit us at sovhealth.com. Nearly half of all Americans experience a mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, eating disorders, and other mental health issues, with an individualized treatment plan that meets your needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-202-0011. That's 866-202-0011. Or visit us at sovhealth.com.
We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's Rancho San Diego facility provides individualized mental health, substance abuse, and dual diagnosis treatment to teens in a safe, nurturing environment.
Everybody there seemed really caring about.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your child. Call Sovereign Health at 866-202-0308. That's 866-202-0308. Or visit us at sovhealth.com.
News. Talk. Evolve. Evolve. 790 KABC.
We are back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder Taylor, and we're talking about harm reduction with our guest, Katie Wickowitz. And right before the break, what were you asking, Dr. Sharma?
Dr. Wickowitz, I was asking about the characteristics of people who succeed in the harm reduction program.
For sure. And there's kind of a great deal of work on this over the years, but generally people with less severity, also people with less negative mood, less kind of general depression and anxiety symptoms, less anger, and those with fewer heavy drinkers in their social network. So they kind of have social networks who are supportive of lower drinking rates and more controlled drinking and reduced drinking. Those are some of the most predictive of being able to achieve low-risk drinking. But then the other side, if I could go there, is people who, you know, where this, it's important to think about harm reduction for people who have tried abstinence over and over and over again and never succeed.
Yes.
Which is the very severe end of the spectrum
as well. The sort of chronic relapsers.
Yes, the chronic relapsers. And yes. These are the most severe individuals with the most co-occurring negative depressive disorders and anxiety and other psychotic disorders. And individuals in that camp, to just keep saying to them, well, you just need to abstain, that doesn't work either. And so a harm reduction approach that's very effective for those individuals is actually working with them. And so I was involved with a program that's still very popular in Seattle, but now throughout the country, of housing first. So taking individuals who are chronically homeless and have never been successful with abstinence from alcohol and providing wet housing, providing housing that allows them to consume alcohol. And what's interesting about those programs is not only do they reduce their drinking, for the first time they actually reduce their drinking, but they also reduce the cost to society. And so individuals are really benefited and society is benefited by letting go of abstinence is the only way.
You're saying really people at two ends of the spectrum. That,
yes.
The sort of mild drinker and the chronic relapser. They both might be candidates or people that succeed in maintaining, or let's not say sobriety, but they don't achieve a diagnosis, if you like, or they get better by still moderating.
Right. And I think a big thing that I like to think about is changing the goalpost from being drinking or not drinking to being functioning, and how well is the person functioning in life and what's their quality of life? Are they satisfied with life? Are they experiencing, you know, good social relationships and maybe employment? Is their physical health okay? So looking at not just that dichotomy of are they drinking or not and how much are they drinking if they're drinking, but rather how are they functioning in life? And that's something I think our treatment programs actually can be very successful in helping people get better quality of life. By reducing their drinking if they come in at heavy levels, or by providing stable housing, and then the stable housing actually can lead to further reductions in drinking.
People that have a drinking problem, let's just say, drink and then they get drunk and then they keep drinking, because that's sort of what the problem is you don't know you've had too much to drink. So I would imagine that somebody needs to be monitored all the time. I understand. I completely understand the idea of not making people feel that it's black or white, you know, you're doing good because you've quit completely, or you're doing bad because you had a drink. And I understand that if we loosen up that attitude, we can have more people at least try to get some help and then maybe get therapy to get to some of the issues that might be troubling them and causing them to drink. I just worry that when we tell people, like, you can moderate, so many people, by the time they're trying to moderate, can't moderate.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's actually a smaller percentage of people that you might think who can't moderate. You know, I really have seen a lot of people be able to moderate. And
that's funny, because I've seen, in my experience, in the many years that I've been around people, and I've had hundreds of women write to me and tell me how much they struggle with, you know, trying to quit drinking in secret.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's a much bigger number than people think, people that struggle that with really not being able to control their drinking.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we all, there's a great line I use with my students, which is the plural of anecdote is not data. And so I think we see cases, and myself included, clinical cases of people being successful. It's in some respects a disservice to people who have a problem who could reduce to just say that that's not a potential, that that's not an option, and to find out for yourself, to see for yourself, to, you know, involved with a program where you are setting goals and monitoring your drinking and having supports. And if that's not working, if that becomes too hard and abstinence is easier, then a lot of people come to that and then are successful in abstinence. I think another piece to remember is that when individuals come into treatment with an abstinence goal or are forced into an abstinence goal, their relapses tend to be much worse than those who actually come to treatment with a moderate drinking goal or who are trained in moderate drinking and protective behavioral strategies. So it actually, not that it's a disservice to recommend abstinence, and in fact, I still recommend abstinence to a lot of my patients as a first step, because I see that, you know, there's someone who has struggled to do moderate drinking on their own, and so I'll say, why don't we try some sobriety sampling of getting some days of abstinence in you, and see how that goes. And a lot of people will say, like, oh, you know, that actually was easier than trying to moderate. And so other people will really, you know, click into a way of drinking that works for them with their social network, and their social network is supportive of lower risk drinking.
Right.
They're not having to hide it, and their social network knows their limits, is supportive of that. So
right.
I just think it's important to remember the spectrum. And we all see slices of that spectrum and feel like that's the right way because that works for that slice, but it's a broader spectrum.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about harm reduction versus abstinence in treatment and recovery from addiction.
So when somebody comes to see you, how do you make that decision? Is it based on history, based on, like we've discussed, the two ends of the spectrum, other characteristics? You would recommend abstinence straight away, or would you say, well, shall we try harm reduction? Is there a preference? And then what guides that preference?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it really is dependent on the individual patient and their own kind of goals as well. But
mm-hmm.
Certainly when I meet with someone who has really high dependence severity, has terrible history of relapsing and has support for abstinence and has a lot of reasons to be abstinent. So a lot of the, if I'm seeing people who, for example, are court referred and have a lot of reasons that abstinence makes the most sense for them, then I will certainly kind of talk to them about that goal and the pros and cons of that goal. Someone who comes to me who has less severe history and maybe more supports for controlled drinking or reduced risk drinking, and who's interested in reduced risk drinking, then we'll work through that goal. One thing that I always do with patients who want a reduced drinking goal is to actually kind of do some sobriety sampling. So one thing that predicts if someone can have a reduced drinking goal is if they are able to actually have some abstinence. And so kind of coming back to Stephanie's comment around if you can never have abstinence, like if you try to reduce drinking, you can never have a day of not drinking, then reducing drinking is going to be that much harder. And so we do always, when I work with clients, we try to always bring in some sober days and days without alcohol and see what life is like without alcohol as well as, you know, with the reduced drinking. And so it really does depend on the individual patient, but on average, I tend towards let's start with where the patient wants to start and meeting them where they're at. And that's actually another really key harm reduction phrase is to meet people where they're at. And so I would never say to someone, you have all the risk, you have to be abstinent, or you're going to sail through this, you can do moderate drinking. I actually like to kind of work with patients to see what their goal is and what supports they have for that goal.
But, you know, most people don't want to actually quit drinking. I mean, they have to quit drinking because
exactly.
They're seeing consequences of their drinking. I can't think of one person I know that was like, I can't wait to just not drink anymore. That had a drinking
right.
problem. So how do you tell people like, yeah, let's try not drinking? Because I'm sure they've thought of that before. So I'm not trying to be confrontational
no.
in any way, shape, or form. I'm just interested in it just from having talked to so many people. I'm interested in your perspective.
Yeah, no, and it's not let's just try not drinking ever again and for the rest of your life. And so I think that's really the distinction is I always start with a place of, you know, how many days of not drinking do you want to start out with drinking together? And so maybe it's 2 days or 3 days or maybe it's just today and just see what that feels like. And that can give us a lot of information too about whether this is someone who maybe could benefit from a medication that would help them reduce their craving for alcohol or would potentially benefit from a detoxification where they are kind of detoxified medically from alcohol. And that's also something I'm really always that's really important to look at because, alcohol withdrawal is deadly. And so I always want to make sure that if someone is coming into me and they want to abstain completely, then I'm actually kind of nervous about if they've been drinking really heavily up till that day
right.
about them going into alcohol withdrawal. So it really is a very complicated picture, and it's not, I think we have to consider the fact that there are folks out there who probably do need, medical detox. And then abstinence for quite some time.
Absolutely.
And then I think there's other people who actually could reduce their drinking and benefit from that in their lives.
Well, we need to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to break down how a harm reduction program is tackling addiction in Los Angeles with Stephanie Campos from Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles. You're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health. We'll be right back.
Trauma can have a negative effect on your mental health and well-being. At Sovereign Health, our clinicians create an individualized program that addresses trauma, substance misuse, and mental health difficulties while promoting strength and mental wellness. Call Sovereign Health at 866-201-9702. That's 866-201-9702, or visit us at sovhealth.com.
Are you or a loved one suffering from an eating disorder? At Sovereign Health, we believe these brain diseases that strain people's lives should not define them. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-202-0209. That's 866-202-0209. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's Rancho San Diego facility provides individualized mental health, substance abuse, and dual diagnosis treatment to teens in a safe, nurturing environment.
Everybody there seemed really caring about.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your child. Call Sovereign Health at 866-202-0308. That's 866-202-0308. Or visit us at sovhealth.com.
Talk Radio 790, KABC News Update. I'm Steve Cumming. A spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board met with reporters about their investigation into today's fatal crash involving a freight train and an Amtrak passenger train that left two dead, as well as 116 others injured in South Carolina. Correspondent Kaylee Hartung is in Casey with the latest.
The key question for investigators, why? Why was that switch locked and lined in the wrong position, diverting the Amtrak train 91, a train that travels that route every day from the main track and onto that siding track to Kareen straight into a parked freight train? That is the question that investigators will be looking into as they continue their work on the ground.
Video from the front of the Amtrak train has been recovered and sent to Washington, where it will be inspected. KABC SoCal weather, mostly clear this evening, then areas of fog overnight with lows in the 50s. More news coming up and continuous coverage on KABC.com. I'm Steve Cumming, Talk Radio 790, KABC News.
We are back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor, and we've been talking about alternatives to immediate drug abstinence and how harm reduction can positively affect an individual's road to a better life. And right now we have Stephanie Campos, who's the executive administrator for Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles, and she has over 10 years of experience in the public and nonprofit sector. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephanie.
Stephanie, tell us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Hello. Stephanie, tell us how does harm reduction work in what you're doing?
Right. So for homeless healthcare, harm reduction basically means that we meet clients where they're at, we create low threshold programming, and we utilize a non-judgmental lens. So we use harm reduction as a foundation and philosophy through all of our programming. And we basically just want to create a really safe environment, comfortable for our clients, and just let them know we're here to help as much as we can.
So what is exactly, give us the nuts and bolts of your program. Patients, how do they find you? What happens when they come in? What are you doing?
Yeah, so Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles, we've been around for 30 years now. We're a nonprofit organization, and we provide an array of services to people experiencing homelessness. So we have, I guess we can divide it up into four different segments. We have a behavioral health component. So this includes substance use, addiction treatment services, mental health services, and people with co-occurring disorders. That's pretty common among our client population. So we use a unique blend of Eastern meets Western philosophical to support the behavioral health care interventions that we use. So this is part of our behavioral health care programming. We also have a housing program. This is our largest department, and it focuses on individuals that have chronic health conditions and other mental and substance use issues. So we use intensive case management services to help clients from when they are experiencing life on the streets to helping them navigate the system, applying for different housing options available in LA County, to permanent housing placement and retention. So once they secure permanent housing, we provide whatever they need to maintain their housing, from eviction prevention to going with them on appointments and helping them get acclimated to their communities.
And do you only use harm reduction when you're talking about interventions with addictions?
So we utilize harm reduction in all of our programming across the board.
Okay.
So just the way we treat our clients and in addiction services.
What percentage of the people that are within your overall service, homeless, healthcare, Los Angeles, what percentage of people have a substance use disorder or any problems with addiction?
Sure. So that's the majority, over half of our clients.
Okay.
And we have, I'm sorry, go ahead.
What about mental illness? Is that, I know that you might have dual diagnosis patients with a comorbidity of mental illness along with addiction. But if we were talking about people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, that don't necessarily have an addiction, what percentage of people would that be?
It's a good 25 to 30% of our clients.
And how do they get help in the sense of, is it programming that you do, like any treatment center, or is it different in any way? I guess it depends on funding.
Right. So we have a few different entry points. One of the ones I mentioned is like kind of a large facility where people can come in and walk through our doors. But another entry point can be outreach. So we do a lot of outreach in the community. We have a team that goes out, multidisciplinary team that goes out into the community to try to engage people that don't leave their encampments. And then we have like health fairs, things like that in the community as well.
Mm-hmm. And are these people mainly on Medi-Cal and you're treating them along those lines? I'm just trying to understand the system in which they are, because using harm reduction in a system where people have no other option might be different to treating people in a system where they might have other options. And that's why I'm probing a little bit just to see what kind of facilities or treatment programs you're running, because we're very interested in the subject and want to inform our listeners accordingly.
Of course. So apart from the entry points I've mentioned, one of the most, like the heart of our agency is what we call it, where you really see harm reduction in its truest form and you see it practiced every day, is our Center for Harm Reduction. It's in Skid Row. It's a syringe exchange program, and other disease prevention programming is in that facility as well.
Uh-huh. And are these people mainly on, would they be on Medi-Cal, or I don't know how?
Yes. So we have different populations we engage with.
Okay.
The specific people that are active injection drug users aren't really on anything whatsoever. A lot of our other clients that are our main site that are getting housing services or behavioral health care treatment programming, mm-hmm. Sometimes they are on SSI. We help them if they're not. So that's one of the services we provide, because it can take many months to get someone or longer on SSI or, you know, whatever they need. And Medi-Cal, a lot of them are.
Right.
But if they're not, we try to help them also
be able to
be on it.
Okay.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about harm reduction approaches with Stephanie Campos, the executive administrator at Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles. So you do a needle exchange program?
That's right.
And is there a chance that a needle exchange program actually could make matters worse, or does it always help?
Right, so we haven't seen any research that shows it could make matters worse in terms of increasing the number of people who begin to use or inject drugs or criminal activity in the areas where these syringe exchanges may be located. So they've been around for decades, and we're very passionate about our work, and we're strong advocates for syringe exchanges. So having somewhere where people can receive sterile syringes and safer injection supplies and dispose of them safely really is disease prevention. It mitigates the spreads of HIV, Hep C, other bloodborne illnesses.
I would imagine with the population at Skid Row, it would be almost impossible to get people to try abstinence, right? I mean, what support systems do they have in place? So this is probably life-saving for many, many people to provide harm reduction.
Absolutely, and we do a lot of overdose prevention awareness and training. We distribute naloxone, Narcan, which is an overdose reversal drug. So our clients, we train them to be able to administer this drug. So if someone that they know is experiencing an overdose, they can go ahead and give them the naloxone and then it can reverse an overdose. So the last 10 years, from the feedback we've received from our clients, there's been over 1,000 overdose reversals they've done. So they are lifesavers. Our staff also does that. We've probably had over 20 in the last year that our staff has reversed. So we save lives, literally.
Good. Wonderful stuff that you do. There might be a criticism that one is perpetuating the use of drugs in our program, in your program, but I feel that it is, you know, something is better than nothing.
We would agree. I mean, that is something we hear, and we just try to do our best to kind of let people know the research and the education behind harm reduction, why we do it. Because if someone didn't have somewhere to use the sterile syringe or be able to obtain these supplies, the studies show they're just likely to go and find these things other places and sometimes put themselves and others in difficult, more risky situations and behavior.
Right.
But do you find that it's hard for people to really change their lives if they're going to continue using drugs? Is there a way? Is there anything that you offer in terms of people that might want to actually, you know, get off drugs and change their lives, get off the street? Is that possible for these people?
Yes, we absolutely think it's possible for these people. We're not here to try and tell people what to do or what not to do and push them into servicing or programming unless they're ready. So we follow like a stages of change model. A lot of the people coming to our syringe exchange are in pre-contemplation, meaning they're kind of just focusing on using at this time. They're not ready. But if they're ready, we are right there, ready to engage with them. We provide medication-assisted treatment, MAT. Treatment,
wonderful.
Which is, it helps our clients on opioids, for example, wean off using drug replacement therapy like Suboxone or buprenorphine to help them taper off the drug and detox. So we do provide that right out of our syringe exchange.
Well, it certainly sounds like you run an enlightened program. What are your sources of funding? I mean, it's everybody should be funding a program like yours.
Oh, thank you. We agree. So, we have various sources of funding. We actually do receive a lot of federal funding, a lot of county, state, local funding. We have a development department. We're able to put together 1 to 2 large fundraising events a year because private funding is always the best. It's unrestricted, so we can kind of decide how we want to utilize the funding as opposed to funding from the county. You know, it's very... it has more constraints, right? So we have an array. We have grants that we, you know, proposals we submit regularly.
Good. Okay. Well.
Well, you know what? We need to take one more break. But Stephanie, do you want to stay on the line with us?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, you can join us, and we're going to bring Katie Wickowitz back and talk more about harm reduction. You're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. We will be right back.
Are you or a loved one struggling with addiction as well as a mental health condition? At Sovereign Health, our clinicians target and treat substance use disorders and a variety of mental illnesses at the same time. We provide evidence-based dual diagnosis treatment services for adults and adolescents based on their clinician's customized rehabilitation plan. Call Sovereign Health Dual Diagnosis Program at 866-866-0534. That's 866-866-0534 or visit sovhealth.com.
Is your battle with mental illness or addiction a daily struggle?
Everybody was an immature adult wanting this treatment.
Sovereign Health's Power Program uses evidence-based treatment to create a lasting recovery in an environment suited to women over 40. Start your recovery at Sovereign Health with the Power Program today. Call 866-202-0303. That's 866-202-0303. 800-273-0303 or visit us at sovhealth.com.
For people that need help, this is the place to be.
Are you tired of struggling with your mental health or addiction? Sovereign Health's Prime program aims to help men over 40 overcome mental illness and chemical dependency in an environment suited to their age and needs. Enter a state of lasting recovery with Sovereign Health and get your life back. Call 866-201-8804. That's 866-201-8804. Or visit us at sovhealth.com.
I'm Tiffany. I have some tips for you on how to quit smoking like I did. First, I did some reading about it. I found a lot of great advice on how to quit smoking and picked out the ways I thought would work best for me. I started by setting a quit date. Then I threw out my ashtrays, lighters, and matches. I did other things too, like exercising more, and it worked. But I'd still get cravings, especially on long car rides. To help me with that, I put a picture of my mother in my car. She died of lung cancer from smoking cigarettes when I was only 16. Now I have a 16-year-old daughter. That picture of my mother reminds me that I don't want to miss all the things my daughter is going to do in her life, including turning 17.
You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Want to be a VIP? Listen to KABC at 8, 10, noon, and 3 to qualify for a shot to roll like a VIP. In Vegas, baby. One lucky winner will receive a two-night stay at the Venetian Las Vegas, a $100 gas card, a $100 spending card, and two VIP tickets to see the legendary band Chicago. Live at the Venetian Las Vegas. Plus, all qualifiers receive a $25 gift card to Norm's Restaurant. Norm's, where life happens. The KABC Roll Like a VIP Vegas Getaway with Chicago. Don't miss Chicago's limited engagement February 7th through the 24th. More details at KABC.com.
News.
Talk.
Evolve. Talk Radio 790. KABC.
Talk Radio 790.
KABC.
We are back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We've been talking about harm reduction with Stephanie Campos, who's the executive administrator at Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles. And now I'm going to bring back in Katie Wickowitz, a professor of psychology and a scientist at the Center on Alcoholism, Substance Abuse, and Addictions at the University of New Mexico.
Stephanie, in the last segment, you mentioned people in the pre-contemplative stage and stages of change. I think our listeners would benefit from knowing what these stages are and how we deal with them and your experience. And then I'll go to Dr. Wickowitz for her views.
Sure. So the stages of change model basically encompasses different stages someone may be in. So I will explain it kind of in the way we explain it when we tour people at our Center for Harm Reduction. Pre-contemplation phase is the first, and it's kind of our clients aren't really focused on getting off drugs, so to speak, and oh, I need to be housed if they're experiencing homelessness. They're more just, okay, I need to use this drug, and that's all I can focus on at this time being. So the next phase would be contemplation, and that's when people might start thinking about other options. You know, maybe I'm ready to take another step and in a different direction. Maybe I want to start, you know, weaning off heroin. So that's when they start contemplating this, what leads into the next phase, action phase, when you take that step and maybe start speaking with someone at our site. Hey, I want to start going on that drug replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. And then the final would be maintenance. So being on that cycle and being able to maintain, you know, new journey that the person decided to take. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the stages of change model
right.
for our work at Homeless Healthcare.
Right. And what are your thoughts or your organization's thoughts on the maintenance of, I know we talked about maintenance of motivation, but how about maintenance Suboxone, for example, as a model in harm reduction?
Right. Yeah. So we do offer Suboxone, and if our clients are interested, we can connect them with it. We are very realistic in the sense that abstinence isn't always something that happens. If that's what our clients want to try to maintain, we're going to be extremely supportive and try to provide everything we can for that to happen. But with like abstinence-based programming, a relapse is seen as something that's a big step back. And here in terms of maintenance, we don't see it that way. I mean, it happens, and then we just work with them to try and keep them on whatever goal that they want to be on. So if that's being on Suboxone, buprenorphine, the MAT services, then that's fine. Sometimes it's too much for clients that are not ready, but that's okay too, because yeah, we can't, you know, force people into treatment that doesn't work.
Katie, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree completely, and the data are really clear on this, that someone who is pre-contemplative, who's not even thinking about change, you know, if you try to tell them they need to change or that they have to change, it tends to be really ineffective. And working with individuals and kind of, you know, nudging them and raising their awareness of how alcohol or drugs might be interfering, and how, you know, kind of also ways that they want to live a better life, and regardless of their alcohol or drug use. And I think meeting people where they're at, recognizing that this is a hard process, that it's hard to change. For all of us, it's hard to change any health behavior, but especially when we're talking about, you know, psychotropic medicine, you know, basic, or not psychotropic medicine, but the alcohol and drugs that change the brain. So meeting people where they're at and working with them at whatever change they want to make, even if that is just talking to someone initially, that meeting people where they are is much more effective than telling them what to do.
How harmful do you think it is that we put such a stigma, such a moral judgment on people who use drugs or people who, you know, use alcohol to excess? And how harder is that for people to quit or to even cut down, knowing that, you know, what people's judgments are?
Yeah, I think it makes our work so much harder. Honestly, I really do. I think it really, the stigma of alcohol and drug use makes it so much harder to get people the help they need. It makes it so much harder for families to help their loved ones get better, regardless of if they still are going to be using. It really exacerbates so many problems that, you know, housing, employment, all the other things that make life hard for a lot of folks, and then throwing a stigma of alcohol and drug use on top of it just really exacerbates it. And I'm excited to hear what Stephanie has to say, too.
Yeah, Katie, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly something we encounter. So we also are a trauma-informed organization. We understand that every single one of our clients that walks through our doors have experienced trauma in their life. That's a given. So we kind of set up our programming to be harm reduction focused and trauma-informed. And absolutely, that there's such a stigma attached to, especially injection drug users, that they're rejected services, that's kind of what they're used to for the most part. We cannot find a way to get this population housed. So they're always turned away.
If we look slightly afar to Europe, we find that, for example, the Netherlands have certain drugs, and education of its population seems to have decreased the number of addicts. And Portugal is the ultimate example where drugs are not illegal, and we've seen a drastic decrease in drug use and associated crime. Any thoughts about the interaction between this and how people get better or stop using drugs?
You're exactly right, that the more we destigmatize and potentially even legalize, the more and more people are going to actually potentially not have problems. It's fascinating how many of the problems that we see associated with addiction are societally imposed. And like Stephanie said, there's a great deal of trauma, and the thing I fight against more than anything is self-shame and self-loathing of people I meet with. They have so much shame and guilt and loathing. It's one of the initial things that we have to actually try to break down before we can even start to talk about their substance use. And part of that is the stigma.
If you're just tuning in right now, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about harm reduction when it comes to addiction and the stigma with Stephanie Campos and Dr. Katie Wickowitz.
seems to be a big pushback or the lack of acceptance of harm reduction from the traditional parts of the industry and the, you know, people that are in the industry because they're in recovery or they've had their own experience. And I know that both Stephanie Wilder-Taylor here and I have had interesting discussions about, is this possible in terms of harm reduction? And certainly she believes in a model that is of abstinence, and she has successfully carried out that model. Do you think this concept can go mainstream, so to speak? Because if you are taking Suboxone, you might not be allowed in an AA meeting. I know that there are some AA meetings that you cannot attend if you're on antidepressants, as I was informed. So any thoughts?
I do think we've come a little ways, honestly, with respect to this. You know, there are changes happening with respect to medication-assisted treatment, and the opioid epidemic has really opened a lot of people's eyes to the fact that there are alternatives to abstinence only, including medication-assisted treatments. And so I think the legalization of marijuana across the country and the shifting societal views of marijuana, which will then, you know, of course, there's going to be more people with cannabis use disorder coming into treatment. But I think that on average, it's a, you know, shift course, and the ship is moving slowly, but it is moving in the right direction, is what I've observed in my 15 years in the field.
Stephanie, thoughts?
Yes, I absolutely agree. It's moving in the right direction. I think the opioid epidemic has placed a big spotlight on the significance of overdose prevention and knowing this can touch a lot of different people in your life. It's not just, oh, people experiencing homelessness are affected or certain populations. It's everybody. It's widespread.
I think that even with people, you know, just not homeless, regular moms in my kind of world, I think if we could get rid of some of the stigma around, you know, it's like it's in the mommy culture, let's just say, you know, having a glass of wine, but suddenly if you have three, you're a bad person, a bad mom. And if we could get to a place where we acknowledge that life is hard, that people have suffered traumas, that people are adults living with the aftermath of a bad childhood, and a lot of addicts are basically just self-medicating, you know, I think we could get to a place where it would be a lot easier to say, I feel like I'm drinking too much and I need help, without having it, you know, being, oh God, that person's a terrible person.
Exactly. Yeah. I think changing the dialogue and having the dialogue about being healthy and about having a good lifestyle and feeling good about yourself and feeling good about life and having it less about how many glasses of wine you're having and really more about taking care of yourself and reducing the harm that substances might be causing.
We are running out of time, but I think the one thing struck me when I think Dr. Wickowitz, you said it is not about whether somebody is continuing to, say, drink or not. It's how they're functioning in their lives. And I think that gives an interesting measure or a barometer in terms of how we should be doing these, how we should be looking at these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have. What a great conversation. I really appreciate everybody's input. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I want to thank Dr. Katie Wickowitz and Stephanie Campos. And you can find more about Stephanie's efforts at Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles at hhcla.org. And Dr. Wickowitz, where can we find you?
You can find me at CASA, CASAA.UNM.EDU.
Wonderful. And don't forget to tune in next Sunday at 5 p.m. for a new episode of In Your Right Mind. And if you like what you hear, you can download this edition of In Your Right Mind as a podcast by going to iTunes or visit inyourrightmind.com to hear this or previous broadcasts of the show. We will see everybody next week. Thank you, Dr. Sharma.
Thank you, Stephanie. Good night, folks.
This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.